Good afternoon. We have in this country, in many cases, a mismatch between students who graduate from traditional four-year universities with debt and can't get jobs in their fields, and on the other hand, employers who can't find employees for the kinds of things that they need to hire people for. In your fall edition of your Focus magazine, you focused on the community of Dayton, Ohio, and talked about how employers have become partners with community colleges and other providers of sub-baccalaureate degrees in meeting that need and in increasing the alignment between education and the needs of industry. So I guess I have two questions that come off of that context. One is, does that mean that the opportunities for this type of collaboration are determined by the industries that exist in any given region, meaning that maybe in one region there's more of a possibility of this kind of partnership and opportunities for sub-baccalaureate degrees, whereas in another region where there may not be much in the way of dynamic industries, those students just don't have much of an option? And the other question is, what is the role of employers in influencing the educational agenda or influencing young people's choices of careers?
So your first question is a lot harder than your second. So I'm going to try to tackle your first one first, because I'm going to struggle to work my way through it and get to the part that I really want to talk about, which is the second. Look, I think there is a significant issue that we've got to grapple with here, which is that our ability to actually be able to describe what we want out of higher education is constrained by some of the things that we talked about earlier. And so you can see this in terms of, I'll describe it as the running complaints that employers have offered over several decades about what they are and aren't getting out of higher education. And so there's lots of evidence here that what we're seeing in terms of this engagement is that employers say they don't like what they're getting, or at least they don't like elements of what they're getting, and they want something different. They want people who are stronger on the generalizable skills, on the critical thinking and problem solving and communication and those kinds of things. You know, the recent AACNU survey that said that employers see majors as secondary to those skills was a real eye-opener to me. At the same time, when you talk about engagement of employers at the level of, say, industry in a region, part of the problem there is that there's a mismatch for people and work. We'll describe them as workers for a minute, and industry. By that, I mean that in the historic model, you or I might have decided, hey, I'm going to go into the manufacturing industry, and I'm going to work my way through a career in the manufacturing industry, and my career is going to last 40 years in that industry, and I'm going to get to a certain point and be done. Well, that's no longer the case for the vast majority of workers in this country. Most people are educated with some set of skills and some set of field, and then they work in different industries. So you might, you know, my example, which is a sort of utilitarian example, is you might get trained as an accountant and start your career in an accounting firm, then decide that you want to do accounting work in a manufacturing firm, then that leads you to the ability to work in the financial services sector. So you haven't stayed in an industry. You've stayed in an occupation. You haven't stayed in an industry. So part of the problem here is, when we talk about the engagement of employers at the level of industry in regions or in communities, that's really hard, because in fact, that's not the nature of the patterns of workers. Workers don't see themselves, at least not nearly as much as they used to, in terms of being able to work in industries. Your second question, I think, is really what's important and urgent, which is the engagement of employers has to increase significantly. Okay, so we get what they don't like. We got that, right? So what are they going to do? That's the question. And we've been asking them that, and they've been asking us the same question. What can we do? And so, you know, let me just articulate, I think, sort of three areas in which I think the engagement of employers can and does need to change. The first is, employers need to do a better job within their own companies, organizations, contexts, in seeing their employees as learners. By that is, being able to treat their employees as people who are on a learning continuum. So that means sharper focus on tuition reimbursement. It means, we've seen lots of cases now, particularly of large companies developing individualized learning plans for workers so that you're actually within your company treating your workers in a different way. Second way in which the employers need to engage in a different way is essentially through their corporate social responsibility functions. That is, which is to see, and again, this is not limited to the private sector, to for-profit institutions, CSR meaning whatever the organization is, seeing whatever their social role might be, to actually articulate that at the level of improving educational attainment at the post-secondary level. So engaging at that community level that we were talking about earlier is really, really important. And the third, and the part that makes at least some in higher education uncomfortable, is we need to engage employers in the public policy work. The public policy advocacy of employers is really important. Employers, particularly the private sector, get the attention of policymakers. They need to weigh in, hopefully in partnership with lots of us, in being able to influence the trajectory of public policy development. If you look at what's happened at K-12 in the last 20 years, employers have had a defining role in being able to influence some of those policy changes we've seen in states and at the federal level. They've weighed in on No Child Left Behind. They've weighed in on charter schools. They've weighed in on all kinds of things. Whether you agree with those things or not, the point is they weighed in. And I think at the post-secondary level, we need the engagement of employers in a very different way than what we've seen in the past in advocacy for public policy that's going to make a difference in terms of getting to that higher degree of societal talent that we need. We need their engagement. This is not simply us in higher education advocating more for us because we need this kind of investment or that kind of outcome. They need to weigh in because they have a central role in the outcomes of those public policy investments. That was probably a longer answer than you wanted. I'm sorry.
Thank you for your presentation. I wanted to address two things. One is you've been saying this. I don't think you said the word, but I think you're saying it, that you're addressing a sense of place throughout the country. So I've heard you address that about the community level, you know, the interaction with the community. Do you find, my first question is, do you find that that's different across the country? Different communities are going to need emphasis in different areas, maybe because of the employers, but also because of the environment. This is Monterey, we have a marine area, we have, you know, different strengths and attributes than maybe somewhere in the central United States. My other question is that the issue on public policy I think is critical, and I'm glad you addressed that, but one of my big concerns is climate change and issues of sustainability. And to what extent can the Lumina Foundation support policies that will improve our situation, improve our outlook, and provide general education to the public that in many cases isn't sufficiently aware of the issues and the challenges that we're going to be facing in the coming decades?
Can you better articulate the first question? Just help me better understand what you...
Yeah. Do you address different regional needs, not just based upon the economy of that region, but also based upon the environment of that region?
Got it. Yeah, so I think on the first question, you're making a very good point, which is that, or I'm taking a very good point from what you're saying, which is that this is not about regional economic development, that in fact there are different things happening in different parts of the country, in different regions, in different communities, in different metropolitan areas that are very important. And I think that's really true. Part of that, if I might zero in on an example, is the level of pre-existing educational attainment in those communities. So you have a different sort of cultural conversation about increasing educational attainment in places where you already have a lot of people with a college education than you do in other places. So we see that. We see that in, you know, certain places, certain communities in the Northeast, very high levels of educational attainment. Or here in this community, or in other places where you see those levels of attainment, and that's a different conversation than you might see in other places where attainment is low or dramatically low, where one of the problems in those that latter group is that the sense of urgency isn't there. that it's just not clear to people why that's so important. So that issue, I think, is pretty important. I also have to say that I've been influenced by people like Richard Florida, who talk about the sort of broader values of what's represented in communities. And I think that education is too often seen as a means to an end. That is, we educate people so that they can then become workers or what have you in society, rather than the fact that education is a part of the value of that community. In other words, it's a part of the vibrancy. The fact that education is taking place is a part of what makes a community so successful. On your second question, we're not working in that space. It's not an area that we work in. There's lots of spaces we aren't working. We don't work in K-12 education as a national foundation, given our resources. But I understand why that's important. I mean, I think one of the issues that we confront in philanthropy is our ability to do more than simply be the sources of innovation, which I think we've been pretty good at in philanthropy for much of the last 50 years. We've got to contribute more to the broader outcomes of what society needs, of what we need as a pluralistic, democratic society. And I think too often we've seen our role as developing innovations that others will scale, and it never happens, or it doesn't happen nearly enough. So part of what places like Lumina you're starting to see are doing is seeing the bigger picture, saying we've got to participate in that scaling. Now, it's not getting to things like climate change that you're talking about, but we do have a broader vantage point than simply, hey, let's develop a really cool boutique model and then hope somebody scales it, which you've seen often in philanthropy. We're saying, hey, let's develop highly innovative models, or let's look at what we already know are highly innovative, result-oriented models, and let's help bring them to scale. That's part of our role in philanthropy.
My question is about people who have a bachelor's degree, but they don't have an education. And I work in teacher training. And I am now conducting quite a project in the Oakland Unified School System. And we have many people that come to us with a bachelor's degree, but lack an education. And I'm finding the real challenges to take those folks with this bachelor's degree and give them an education so they can make an effective contribution in that K-12 system. Because they have to understand that the bachelor's degree is just part of a complete circle.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing. And I'm wondering, what are your feelings on that?
Well, I mean, you're reinforcing, obviously, the argument that, look, the degree is not the only thing, but the degree should actually have value, should have meaning, and that our ability to actually, whoever is awarding those bachelor's degrees for those people who don't have an education, they're doing us a disservice, right? They're not doing just those individuals a disservice. They're doing us as a society a disservice. So being clear about what those outcomes are that we want from higher education, what should be represented in these credentials, and then our job in higher education is making sure that people actually have those competencies, actually meet those outcomes. That's the critical part. We don't really have that. What we have is a large system that in many ways served our society pretty well in the past, but simply isn't going to serve it well going forward, in part because of the reasons that you're talking about.
My second part is we have general assumptions. Everybody went to college in this group, so therefore they must be educated. And the assumption is, well, we all in public school at one time, or elementary school, or we all went to second grade, so we know what second grade is.
Yeah.
And I see the disconnect between we think we know what second grade is, but we truly don't.
Yeah.
And society has changed, and the communities have changed. And we have lost sight of that that rapid change and our ability to keep pace with it.
So I did a, you can tell that I've spent much of my career in public policy because I tend to reflect back on public policy outcomes, so I apologize. I did an op-ed last year in one of the DC-based newspapers called Nostalgia is No Way to Make Public Policy. And in part because I literally got tired of going into a member of Congress's office, going into a governor's office, going in to meet with a legislator, and then I'd hear that dreaded phrase, that the one that immediately would set me off. When I was in college, because I immediately realized they have no idea what they're talking about. They do not know what's happening at places like CSU Monterey Bay. They haven't been there, and that system has changed a lot since they were there, and it is going to change rapidly and astronomically more in the next few years. So part of it, I think that's right. It's a conundrum that we've faced in education for a long time, which is that people who make decisions, and I don't want to just beat up on policymakers, it also includes business leaders, it includes lots of people. They think that their own experience is reflective of what's happening in that context today. And it's simply not. I went to an unbelievably good public high school. I grew up in Connecticut. Probably one of the best in the country at the time. I have no idea if that school does anything close to what it did when I went there. I was very fortunate to go to a place that was that good. But I highly doubt that what they're doing now is the same as what they did in the late 70s. I highly doubt it. So that's the point, is that our ability to actually recognize that change is happening, and it's happening in different ways. Some places are getting better, some places are not, is a really important part of the calculus.
Hi, I want to thank you so much first for the important work that Lumina does. And you talked about how important it is to engage faculty and grassroots energy, and also the context that we currently face of increasing resource scarcity. When I think about scalability and increasing capacity, these tend not to be the concerns of a classroom teacher.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, do faculty and policymakers have different goals and interests? And if so, how do we reconcile those differences?
Well, the short answer is probably some of them, yes. Some of them do have different goals and interests. I certainly hear as much misunderstanding from policymakers about faculty as I do from faculty about policymakers. So I think there's a disconnect there that you see, at least in some contexts. My point is simply that in order to get to this change that we need, we have got to engage those people. So your point about there's a sort of lack of relevance to people who are in the classroom and working extremely hard on being able to get engaged in these conversations, I don't want to accept that. I want them to be engaged. I want them to see the bigger picture. And I think there's lots of faculty who, in fact, are willing and excited to be engaged in those things. Fundamentally, this is a field. If you call us an industry, some people are offended by that, but call us an industry where change is about to happen very fast. You can see it in terms of all the ways in which learning is being democratized, and what we essentially had a monopoly on is over, and our ability to actually continue to function in the way that we functioned in the past isn't going to be possible. My point is, now is a really important time for faculty to engage and to be a part of that change, as opposed to simply waiting for it to happen. In lots of other industries where we've seen change, the engagement of the people who are in the sector fundamentally influenced the direction in which it went. I want to see faculty a part of that. I think it's very important. But these are hard conversations. The hard truth is that there are winners and losers in this. You don't want to be on the side of the losers. I get that. But I think it's better to be engaged and to be a part of the conversation than simply let it happen to you. And that's my appeal to faculty is, much as it's my appeal to business leaders, mm-hmm. get in the game here. Mm-hmm. Be a part of the conversation. Don't leave it to people like these two people, right?
Thank you.
It's too important for you to not be engaged.
Thank you again for coming and for sharing this time with us. As you might know, one of the CSUMB's key areas of focus since its development has been on civic engagement and our involvement of our students in community through service learning and other kinds of active learning. As we started to work with the DQP in our assessment work on campus, I was really thrilled to see that civic learning is one of the five focal areas, which is fabulous to see. I'm just curious, as the beta testing has gone on, how you found a reaction to that. Because in our understanding, as we've developed this work, we're kind of unusual in that in many cases, and even if you look historically in higher ed, civic learning has kind of been a means to an end,
right,
as opposed to an end in and of itself. It's a means to perhaps more rigorous outcomes-based focus,
yes,
right? Getting the basics down. It's a means to better harmony with the workforce demands, right? But the public purpose of higher ed,
yes,
which we know is so important, doesn't really get embraced by our disciplines, by the core structures. Even more worrisome to me is the continued call to, we need the private sector involved in helping us understand, you know, what's really important here. So I'm curious as to, one, the reaction that you found to this focus on civic learning. Have people sort of understood it through their own lenses for their own purposes? That's one. And second, why aren't we calling for communities to really have a voice in,
yeah,
what should be going on in higher education as well, in addition to our private sector?
It's a really good point. You know, speaking on behalf of Lumina Foundation, we think community, you heard my appeal on communities. I think it's very important for communities to weigh in here. The anecdotal evidence on the DQP is that the civic learning part has gone very well. So I'm pleased with that. I'm pleased with that in part because if you look at these comparable efforts in other countries, it's not even there. Civic learning is not even a part of the qualifications frameworks in most of the rest of the world. It is, in that sense, if not unique, highly unusual American thing to see the civic outcomes, the civic competencies of learners as a core part of our expectations of what degrees should represent. So I'm really thrilled about that and also truly impressed with what CSU Monterey Bay does here. You're nationally regarded. You know, everyone recognizes that. I think part of the challenge in the civic learning part is for it to not become disconnected from the other elements. We don't want to treat this as an add-on. We want to treat this as a core part of, as you said, those five areas of competency. And what I don't know yet, because we haven't seen the evidence, is whether it's being treated with the same level of gravitas as broad integrative knowledge, what have you. So,
guys, one follow-up point, because you made reference to South Africa. I was lucky enough to be a Fulbright there doing work on civic education a couple of years ago, really looking at those higher education standards that were developed. And there is a really beautiful articulated focus on social responsibility and,
yeah,
the needs of graduates to be able to live in that post-apartheid South Africa. And unfortunately, that's really just dropped away because that hasn't been defined in really clear outcomes that have been embraced by the disciplines and the degree programs, that it seems as this thing that's just hanging out there. And that's something that I really want to reinforce, the importance of that integration within the framework of the knowledge base of those degree programs.
That's well said. And I'll make one more reference to South Africa and the point back to the United States. Every country, every state, every community really needs to fashion what it sees as best for what works in that context. So I'm a strong believer as Americans that we need to learn the lessons of higher education change in other parts of the world. I don't think we've paid enough attention. Bologna is an example of something that we learn from. I don't want to bring Bologna to the United States. Bologna doesn't work in the United States. But there are things that we can learn from Bologna that we can apply here. And it's our ability to do that's really important. One of the things, if I could speak very candidly, that I was concerned about in South Africa that has turned out to be true, is that the South Africans spent a lot of time in the post-apartheid era consulting too many other countries about their solutions to their problems and didn't spend enough time trying to figure out what was really going to work for them. And then economic challenges started to hit them, and they really hadn't made the kind of national progress that they needed to make to get to that consensus. And they made some decisions that were good, but they missed some opportunities, in my opinion. And so the kinds of things that I think are important is to study what's happening in other countries, but make sure, or other contexts, make sure you take the time to have those broad conversations that we were talking about earlier. I don't know if you ever heard this phrase when you were in South Africa, but the South Africans used to joke they used to call them the transformation tourists, which was all of these people from other countries that were going to South Africa to help in the transformation. And what they really needed was actually to cull the lessons of what was happening in other parts of the world and then get those people out so they could actually come up with their own solutions. Mm-hmm. My view is that as Americans, we need to learn more about what's working and isn't working in Korea, in South Korea right now. Dramatic changes in educational attainment in South Korea, literally in the last 15 years. Well, so how have they done that? And are there things that we can actually learn from that? I mean, you've seen some things written about this, about what's worked and what hasn't, but there's a lot more to be learned from that. Australians have gone through extraordinary change in higher education in terms of their student financing structures and in terms of their qualification system in the last decade. Major change. Australia, by the way, becoming a major focus of foreign student enrollment, right? So they're literally eating our market share in Australia for students that want to go to English-speaking countries. So what can we learn from the Australian experience? Those are the kinds of things that I think are really important for us to do. But let's not adopt the Australian income-based repayment student loan system. Let's figure out what worked for them, and then let's apply it to our American context.
I most certainly agree about the need for education and the talent gap, I'll call it that. I've had many occasions to speak to Rotary clubs, chambers of commerce, et cetera, and most certainly the figures speak for themselves. I usually get a very empathetic nod or two. And however, many times what I get from business leaders is that they say to themselves, we can fix this problem. What we need to change really are the immigration laws. All right, because we can bring in the talent from all over the world if we need it. And if we can't bring the talent in, we'll export the jobs. So to help me better craft answers for that, I thought perhaps I'd ask you what some of the answers or retorts you would use to answer those questions. Thank you.
We're about to engage in, I think, a very important immigration policy discussion in our country, long overdue, in my opinion. And I think it's terribly important. I think that from my vantage point, American talent has to take into account several things. The first is we are a country of immigrants. And that culture of immigrants driving our economic and social prosperity needs to continue. But what we need is, and I'm going to come back to the point of employers in a second, we need an immigration policy that takes the continuum of talents into account as we figure out how to fashion immigration reform. So we must address the issue of the 11 million undocumented people for whom we have no place, but they're not going anywhere. It makes no sense that we simply try to ignore them and try to figure out unworkable policy solutions that simply aren't realistic. We've got to deal with that. At the same time, we've got to deal with the people who have some skills but who need greater levels of talent in order to be able to be a part of the middle class in our country. And we need to deal with the very real problem of the fact that we aren't producing enough graduates in certain areas where we have the talent needs that exist in our society. So part of the issue for employers, and I actually think employers will be playing a constructive role here in the immigration debate, is for them to weigh in on the totality of the talent needs for American society. So I was part of a group from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs that was a nonpartisan, bipartisan group with six former governors, Republicans and Democrats, business leaders, civic leaders, education leaders. We had the right wing, the left wing, and the I don't know what wing, everything in between, all coming together around the single idea that immigration reform is critical to our future as a country, that creating that change is very important. And I think employers in particular need to have a clearer voice on this and not simply speak to one end of the continuum, but to the whole end of the talent continuum. That's part of what I think is going to need to happen in order for us to be able to get the comprehensive immigration reform that's desperately needed for the country. So this is a tough issue. It's a really challenging conversation. I'm someone that, you know, comes from an immigrant family. I wouldn't be sitting here were it not for immigration policy. So I certainly understand the importance and value of it. But those immigration policies are so outdated, they really don't have relevance to what our current societal needs are. Immigration, by the way, is an element of getting to Lumina's 60% goal. We've got to figure out not only how we produce those 23 million more graduates that we need to produce beyond what we're currently producing, but we need to figure out what element of the group of people who are already here contribute to that total from an immigration perspective, whether they're undocumented or people that currently have legal status, but who we might send back to another country when we could better retain them here. So those kinds of issues, it's complex, but what I'm hoping is that we stay focused on the continuum of needs and not see this thing unravel yet again, like it did 6 years ago, because of a single issue that brings the whole thing down.
We'll take one last question.
So I admire Lumina's goal of 60% of college graduates, and my question surrounds persistence of the students. Our campus in its founding started out ideally thinking about year-round operation, outcomes-based education, alternative assessment, lots of different pathways for students, and we would get them here, and then they wouldn't stick. And we're doing much better in terms of retaining our students, but the overall persistence rate, both in the CSU and at our particular campus, is not great. And I'm wondering how the Lumina Foundation can help to support the persistence rate, and relatedly, also about the out-of-classroom experience. We're talking about students as if the only learning they do is in the classroom, but I think increasingly we're having students who are having difficulty with mental health issues, coping, making good relationship decisions, making good health decisions that is not being addressed, but directly affect their ability to succeed in the classroom. When I hear about online, I get very nervous about the students who are not having those face-to-face opportunities to address the out-of-classroom learning as well.
Yeah, so we're doing a lot in this area is the short answer, because increasing the success rates for students who are already in higher education is terribly important. And those of you who know the educational research know that, you know, we've known for a long time, you go back to Vince Tinto's research in the 1980s around this, that social integration on campus is the single most important thing that drives persistence and retention, eventual graduation. So being able to better understand what motivates students to leave, which is usually one of three things: money, academics or family and social problems. Those are the three issues that come together. That's a critical part of the retention equation. You know, I will say that part of what I think we haven't really grappled yet with in higher education is the fact that it takes too long to get a college degree. And that time is a part of the problem for too many of the people that we serve. It's not just the old debate about, well, you know, a quote-unquote four-year degree takes 5 or 6 years. But the fundamental question is, how much of this is really about the time, and how much of it is about those outcomes that you get, whether they're learning outcomes or other outcomes, in the time that you do have here? And because of credit hours and the fact that we use time-based units as a primary measure of progress in our system, we tend to equate time with the outcomes. CSU Monterey Bay obviously has a different model, I understand, but that is still the dominant model in American higher education. So in a system where time is the enemy for too many students, particularly those low-income, first-generation, minority students, the adults, we've really got to grapple with this issue about how much time we really need them to be engaged in the system. There's a finite point here, right? I'm not articulating a view that somehow we're going to create a pill and people are going to take it and they're going to be smart and they're going to have a college degree and you can do it in 1 second. My point is that I think that we've got to make sure that time is one of the factors we concentrate on, because for too many of those students, life gets in the way, and the reality of their life is what ultimately impedes them because of those social or those academic or those other family and social pressures that they face. So we've been experimenting with some interesting ideas, not at scale yet, so it's part of the old philanthropy model that we're hoping to bring into the new model around accelerated programs. And we've done just an interesting one that I'll mention because it's not too controversial in this context, which is an accelerated associate degree. So we've been experimenting with accelerated associate degrees in our home state of Indiana. It's an 11-month associate degree program. And in this 11-month program, the students go full-time. They are in a highly structured program. Essentially, their job is to get a college education. They are in school 9 to 4, so it literally is much like a job. And interestingly, in the model, in the experiment that we're doing right now, we're actually paying them a stipend so that their other distractions, having to work, having to deal with these other obligations, don't get in the way. It has been highly successful. By the way, it's not clear that the stipend is as important as we thought it is. That's one of the research results that we're trying to assess. But the success rates for the students in this program compared to their peers, where they're coming from, are pretty high. The success rates in the first 3 years that we've done this are about 80% for those students. That is way off the charts for community college success rates, and I think that's encouraging. So seeing time as one element of this is something that I really want to encourage us to do. I don't like these oversimplified models of saying you have to get your bachelor's degree in 4 years. It has to be at those kind of oversimplified approaches don't make sense. But being clear that time is a factor we've got to concentrate on and we've got to bring down the time to degree, that's really important for us in higher education.
Well, I can't resist mentioning at this point our own 3-year degree effort in collaboration with community colleges here in Monterey, this computer science information technology degree that we have a full cohort that was just put together. They're going to receive a full ride through a very generous gift from the Matsui Foundation. And in fact, it's received quite a bit of notice. The NSF is going to recognize it in the coming weeks.
That's
in
wonderful.
Washington. And Governor Brown has been buttonholing me about it at the Board of Trustees meetings. So
good. I'm glad to hear
on that one. Well, I want to ask you to please thank Jamie Marisotis for a wonderful talk.